Welcome to the Cleveland Public Library's Sports Research Center and our conversation with iconic sports broadcaster Joe Tate, the voice of the Cavs. Joe was hired as the voice of the Cavs 8 games into their first season in November of 1970. Except for 2 seasons during the turbulent Ted Stepien regime in the early 1980s, Joe was a fixture behind the mic until his retirement in April 2011. Joe was the last of the pro basketball announcers to work solo with no analyst or color man. He kept his own running stats and he never missed a shot. He also broadcast Cleveland Indians games on radio and television from 1973 through 1987. We should point out that Joe did not retire completely. He was still broadcasting Mount Union football games on television when we talked with him on November 29th, 2012. We begin with Joe Tate. Joe, welcome to the Cleveland Public Library's Icon Series. Your books are here in the library. Of course, as people listen to this many years from now, this is the end of November of 2012 when Joe Tate and I are sitting here talking. Your books are in the library. I hope that when people listen to this, your books are still here. Who knows? It may be 50 years from now that people are listening to this. Let's begin with your life as a broadcaster. Joe Tate, a legendary broadcaster, Cleveland Cavaliers basketball. But how did you get started? Born in just north of Chicago, Evanston?
Born in Evanston, Illinois in 1937.
And then you bounced around the Chicago area.
Yeah, my dad worked for the phone company and was involved in switching the system over from operators to automation and dial and all that other stuff. Yeah.
And did you really want to be a broadcaster from your youth?
No, I think the thing I wanted to be first and foremost for a long time was a teacher. And in fact, ended up with a scholarship to Northern Illinois State Teachers College in DeKalb. And then I went down to Monmouth College to visit my cousin and also just look it over. And I really liked it a lot. And so out the window went the teaching, and I went to Monmouth and decided I wanted to be a sports writer.
A sports writer?
Yes, think of that.
An ink-stained wretch. Yes. Welcome to the club.
Yes. I'm going to take all my prerequisites at Monmouth and then transfer to the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri.
Really?
That was the plan.
Oh, you were really serious about that.
Oh, yes, I was. And I was the sports editor of the paper, the sports editor of the yearbook. I became the sports information director. It's a very small college. And so all of my activities were aimed at, as you say, the printed word. And then they opened a radio station in Monmouth. And I took some of my written work down there on a Saturday afternoon to see if they wanted to use it. The fellow who was at the controls happened to own the radio station, and he said, well, he said, I don't know anything about sports, but we got a sportscast coming up here in a little while. Why don't you go in the newsroom and gather up some stuff on the wire that, you know, I'm saying wire, people don't even know what that is, but take it off the wire and give me a 5-minute sportscast. And I did. And when I was done, he motioned me back into the control room and said, how'd you like to have a job? Well, I thought, holy cow, 1 5-minute sportscast, and he wants me to be the next Bill Stern. And then he brought me back to reality in a hurry when he said, we need a janitor. So I was looking for a variety of jobs to help get through school, and so I had a turn as janitor at the radio station for $1 an hour, which was minimum wage in those days. Then he said, he said, you weren't too bad doing that sports. He said, how'd you like to, what should have tipped me off right away, he said, how'd you like to learn to be a sports announcer? And I said, well, yeah, fine. He says, okay. he says, here's what we're going to do. You can be the janitor. However, as sports announcer, you're learning. So that means you're not really getting paid for it. In fact, because you're learning, that's going to cost you $1 a day. And so I suddenly was down to zippo with two jobs. But it was the smartest thing I ever did to say, okay, I'll do it. Because in a place like that, turnover was often rapid and sometimes surprising. And the next thing I know, I'm the news director. And then the next thing I know, I'm the program director as I'm filling in for people who have left and they haven't replaced yet. And pretty soon, I had worked at the station to the point where I'd done just about everything there was to do there, with the exception of engineering. And I've also realized that if I went out and sold the broadcast of Monmouth College football and basketball and Monmouth High School sports, I could, A, get a talent fee for doing it, like $5 a game, and I could also get a commission, of a sales commission. And now I'm starting to work in the black a little bit. And so that's exactly how I got started doing all of that.
Okay. Then in the meantime, you meet Bill Fitch at that time, right?
Or, yes.
Okay. And that later becomes a part of your life a couple of years later.
Yeah, 17 years later.
Was it that long?
Yeah. Bill started at Coe College. He had gone to Coe College, then gone into the Army, and then came back, and he was a basketball coach at Coe, and he also scouted for the football team, because when he had been at Coe, he also played football. And he used to come over and scout Monmouth games every so often when our opponent would be their next opponent. And he used to watch these horrible travesties on the gridiron, 45-0, 64-0, 72-6, that kind of stuff. And he said, I don't know how you do it. How do you get so excited, and how do you sound so happy when your team is just getting murdered? And he said, you know, you can turn a 66-0 blowout into a 6-6 tie. And well, he went his way. Mm-hmm. I went mine. We bumped into each other from time to time, but had no close association.
But your way then led you to teaching at Ohio University.
Yep. I was there and doing their sports and also instructing. And I don't think the academicians would want me to say I was teaching, but I was instructing.
Well, now, was that in the mid-60s you were at OU?
66, 67, 68.
Okay.
Yeah. And I left town the day the students tried to burn down the bookstore and the president's house.
Really?
And it was at that point I decided I'd had enough of academic life and all that went with it.
And you went back to the radio business.
Went back to the commercial radio business and moved back to Bloomington, Normal, Illinois, and then on to Terre Haute, Indiana. And when I was at Terre Haute, the general manager died. And I was summoned to fill in for him until they found another one. That's what I thought they were doing. What I didn't know was they were getting ready to sell the station, so they weren't going to find anybody till the new owners took over. Well, I happened to read in the small print in the Terre Haute newspaper that Bill Fitch had been named head coach of the brand-new Cleveland Cavaliers. So I just sat out. I dropped him a note. Dear Bill, hey, congratulations. I know you're going to have great success with the Cavaliers, and by the way, if you ever need anybody to do for the Cavaliers what I used to do for the Fighting Scots of Monmouth, 66-0, let me know. Sent it, forgot it. In Cleveland, meanwhile, Nick Mulledy and the guy who did the first seven games, here's one of the great trivia questions of all time. Who was the first play-by-play announcer for the Cleveland Cavaliers?
Well, I can remember him. Bob Brown, wasn't it?
Bob Brown, very good.
Yes.
If there was one guy in town who could remember that, I know you could. And But he was also Nick Mulledy's right-hand man.
That's right.
And therefore, Nick said, well, I can't have you wandering around doing basketball games. I want you right here with me on a regular basis, so we got to find somebody to do the games. You know, and at the time, Bob said, well, that could be a little difficult because we've played seven games and been routed in all seven. And, you know, the local guys already know how bad the team is, and we can't afford to pay anybody from out of town. So what we got to find is some guy who would be willing to come in and just have a great time doing NBA basketball for next to no money. And Fitch was in on the conversation. He says, you know, I know just the guy. He said, I don't know what he's doing. I don't know where he is. But if I can find him, I'll see if he wants it. Goes back to his office, and my letter's lying right there on his desk. So he picks up the phone, calls me. The next night, I'm in Cleveland for the Cavaliers home opener. And as they say, the rest is history. Because when I called back after Nick had said, okay, you're my man, when I called back to Terre Haute to tell them I was leaving, new job, they said, good for you because the new owners just came in here today and fired everybody. So I actually didn't have a job. I just didn't know it till I called back home.
So the Cavs were terrible.
Yes.
They lost, I think, the first 15 games.
Yep, lost 15, 1-1. Lost 12, 1-1, lost 9. If you add that up, that's 2-36. Then they beat Buffalo and Philadelphia back-to-back at the old Cleveland Arena. And then, of course, slipped back into into total mediocrity. But they were, they're 15-67 in the first year.
Yes. Did you ever think you made a mistake?
Well, I don't know. It was such an experience that I didn't really stop to think about it. I had taken about a 50% pay cut to come to Cleveland and do the Cavaliers. So then I was picking up things on the side. I was working out at WJW Radio. I was the leg man for Harry Jones and his ill-fated sports show they tried to put up against Pete Franklin. But it gave me money.
Now, refresh my memory. I don't remember Harry Jones with a radio sports show.
Oh, yeah. Sure, see, that tells you just how successful it was.
Wow.
If you don't remember it, nobody remembers it. But
well, was Pete Franklin then on WERE?
Yes.
That was the station carrying the Cavs?
Yeah, and the Indians. And the nice thing about it is when Harry's show evaporated, a couple of things happened. I moved to Sunday morning news on WJW Radio, and shortly thereafter, Harry had a heart attack. He was doing the Indians on TV with Mudcat, and he had a heart attack, and Bill Flynn called me and asked me if I could fill in for Harry on TV. And they had Rocky Colavito, who came in at that point. So Rocky Colavito and I did the 72 season in baseball on TV. And needless to say, I was a little thunderstruck when I was discovered I was going to work with Rocky because, I mean, you're talking legend here.
Yeah.
But he and I got along great, and I really enjoyed my association with Rock. And I think one of the reasons why Herb Score and I had such a great relationship was I think Rocky put his stamp of approval on me with Herb.
Oh, well, now, before I get back to baseball, let's touch on a few more events in your relationship with the Cavs. You guys, you were the voice of the Cavs for virtually their entire existence up until about 2010, except for a couple of years when Stepien owned the team. We'll get to that in a second. 1976, it looked like the Cavs were the best team in the NBA suddenly, in only their sixth year of existence.
Yep.
And we thought that this team is going to win the NBA championship.
And it should have. Unfortunately, Jim Jones broke his foot between the end of the Washington series, which was a seven-game screamer, and the start of the Boston series.
Now, Jim was the big center, 6 foot 11 or 7 feet tall. But and yeah, and so now we have to go into the Boston series with old Nate Thurmond.
Yep, Nate now playing 42 minutes a night against Dave Cowens, who was in the prime of his career. And Nate gave it everything he had, but there wasn't that much gas left in the tank, and they took us out in six games.
And so you do believe the Cavs would have won the entire thing?
Absolutely, without doubt. We had taken Boston 4 out of 6 in the regular season. We had beaten Phoenix both there and here, and that was the team that came out of the West. And there's no doubt in my mind, we would have won it all had Jim not broken his foot.
And if that doesn't happen, how would the Cavs' immediate future been affected by that if they had won it all?
Well, it probably would have thrown a few more coffers, into the pot. But I don't know that it would have hastened the anything more than things that were going, because they still had 54 owners, and Nick was still doing it with mirrors, and on top of that, he was doing it with mirrors with basketball, with baseball, and with the radio station and the hockey team. So
how about your relationship with Nick Milletti? Did you like him?
Yeah, in fact, I still have a relationship with Nick. We still talk occasionally, and when he gets back into Cleveland, we're just not often much anymore, but I've broken bread with him on occasion, so... Yeah, I had a great relationship with Nick.
But now his relationship with Bill Fitch crumbled back in...
After 9 seasons.
Okay. What do you know what happened there?
Yes. Bill had an offer to go to Portland, and Milletti would not let him out of his contract to go to Portland because Milletti did not feel it was right for Fitch to go from one of those teams that came in at the same time and then move over to Portland. Portland, Buffalo, and Cleveland all came in at the same time. So he said the only way you get out is if you're going to a top team. And by golly, the Boston Celtics made him an offer, and Milletti said, okay, you go to Boston, even though Boston had a horrible year, you go to Boston, I'll let you go. So it was just a matter of ego and image. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of sad there at the end where the two of them really did not have a lot of simpatico the last couple of years that was culminated in where Fitch was going to coach next.
And then we had the turbulent days of Ted Stepien.
Turbulence, a good way to put it.
But now you actually worked for Ted Stepien for a while.
1 year.
1 year. How was that?
That was horrible.
Was it?
Yes. In fact, the radio station gave the broadcast rights back to Ted, saying they did not want to be associated with Ted Stepien and his version of the Cavaliers. And, of course, when they gave the rights back, they, in essence, gave my job back. And so I made a cash settlement with the radio station, and then moved on to the New Jersey Nets for a year and the Chicago Bulls for a year before Gordon Gund rescued the franchise and called and asked if I would come back and resume my duties as the play-by-play announcer for the Cavs.
When Ted Stepien was going through coaches like every 3 months.
Yeah, it was a lot of times the same guy, Don Delaney, Bill Musselman. I mean, he was rotating. It was insane, just insane.
And then I think he had Chuck Daly. Was he here? And
39
Chuck Daly
days.
Never moved out of the Holiday Inn or
That's
something
right.
out there.
That's right.
Yeah.
Chuck Daly. I was working with New Jersey, and Chuck Daly came over to me before a ball game. I never met him.
Really?
And said, would you have dinner with me after the ball game at the Tavern of Richfield?
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, sure, yeah, I'd be happy to. He said, I'll tell you all about it when I meet you. And sure enough, he showed up after the game, and he said, I'm buying you dinner tonight because I keep calling home and telling my wife and friends what's going on here. Nobody believes me, but you went through it for a year. I got to believe I can tell these stories to you, and you will at least nod your head and say, I believe you, Chuck, I believe you. And that's exactly what happened. He just told me all of the ridiculous things that had happened under his watch, which was only 39 days long. And, you know, and he had suffered the same things that I had suffered through. And
so he was just looking for somebody to verify his version.
Exactly. Somebody who would believe him.
Yeah. So then Gordon Gunn buys the team, and things were very calm for many years. Too calm.
Probably.
He never splashed the water around.
No.
It was...
not his style.
Yeah. And I'll never forget. Now, this is my story, not yours. But when Dan Gilbert bought the Cavs from Gordon Gund, and they both sat there at a press conference on the floor of the basketball court, and they've always the question is, what do you have any advice? The question for the departing Gordon Gund, what advice do you have for the new owner? And Gordon Gund said, patient, be patient. I almost fell off my chair. Yeah. Patient. We've been patient for how many years with Gordon Gund? Do not be patient. Be impatient.
Yeah, well, they both made bad mistakes. You know, Gordon being impatient once in his life, he got rid of Harper.
Yes.
Before there was any real proof that he was in trouble with the law. They just, the DEA and the cops had told Gordon that, hey, he's associating with some rather bad people, and, you know, and his car had been used, I guess, in some kind of a drug buy, although he was not there at the time. And Gordon, being straight-laced as he is, just said, that's it. I want him out of here. 2 weeks. I don't care where you send him, what you do with him. Get him out of here. Well, the only other player in the league that was in a similar situation, but for different reasons, was Danny Ferry, out with the Clippers, because he refused to sign with the Clippers. And so the deal was made, and the Cavaliers threw in 2 first-round draft choices as insurance in case Harper ended up in the can.
Oh, gee.
And even then, people, well, they're gonna, you know, the Cavs are going to have a great year, and those draft choices will be very low in the first round. So, you know, no problem there. Well, of course, injuries hit the Cavs that year, and the first-round draft choices became very good. Of course, the Clippers screwed it up, but that's neither here nor there. But I know Michael Jordan said that had Ron Harper stayed with the Cavaliers, that they definitely would have beaten the Bulls at least once, because he said Harper was the toughest guy he had to face in the league night in and night out. And so, and that was the one time that Gordon splashed the waters. And then, of course, your story is absolutely true. Dan Gilbert waited about 30 seconds after getting the answer and started splashing his own. You know, and he got rid of Paul Silas almost instantly, which I thought was a classic blunder, because Paul Silas was the right coach for that team at that time. But it was Dan's team, and Dan was going to do it his way.
Why was Silas the right guy for that team? Because of the way he could handle LeBron James?
Yes, he was the father figure. He was, you know, he was tough. He was tough. I think Byron Scott and LeBron James would have been a good matchup, because I think Byron is an excellent coach. I don't care what the one loss record says. Byron Scott is an excellent coach and is well suited to deal with the rather interesting personalities that come across the line in the NBA these days.
Well, to finish the Ron Harper story, he never did get into any trouble. And he was essential in helping. Didn't he play for the Bulls as they won championships?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. He had a great, great career.
Yes.
And straightened himself out, got married, had kids.
Yeah. Lenny Wilkins, I believe, in his book, he came right out and said that when they traded Ron Harper, they traded away any chance they ever had of beating the Bulls. He said he was, according to Lenny Wilkins, and essentially he just repeats what you just did, and that Ron Harper was the only guy in the league who could guard Michael Jordan.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, that is very, very true, and that was sad because I think there could have been a championship or two in there for the Cavs if Harper had stayed.
And it turned out Harper was a pretty good guy. Yes.
Yep.
And so then, but the LeBron James years, they were bittersweet. He was a difficult guy to work with. Everything had to be his way from what we could tell.
I would just say this. All LeBron really wanted to do was play ball and play the way that we saw on occasion LeBron play, which was spectacularly.
Yes.
But the Cavaliers wanted him to be a leader. Leadership was not in LeBron James' vocabulary. He didn't want to be a leader, couldn't be a leader, never was a leader. One of the reasons things have worked out in Miami is he doesn't have to be the leader down there in Miami, and so therefore he's happy as a clam, and they've won a championship down there with him. But he just was not in a position to step up and lead that Cavalier team, and there was nobody else that was anywhere near that leadership role.
Well, now, early in his career, I can remember LeBron saying, and being quoted in the paper as saying this also, that this is my team.
Mm-hmm.
Well, evidently, he did not mean that he was the leader of that team.
Well, LeBron's idea of this is my team and the Cavaliers' idea of this is LeBron's team were two different things. It was one of those things where LeBron just, maybe he wanted to inside somewhere, I don't know, but he could not assume the mantle of leadership.
Can you define leadership in this context? How does one be a leader on a basketball team?
I think a guy that A, has the respect of everybody else on the club, who can lead by example, but also who can sublimate himself on occasion for the best interests of the ball club, and who can also establish a working relationship, and I think this is very important, a working relationship with the coach. They have to kind of get on the same page.
LeBron seemed to be always on his page. I always thought that he was a very selfish player, both on and off the court. Is that a subject you would approach at all?
Well, I don't know about off the court. I really had very little to do with him off the court. Mm-hmm. I think there were times when, he got into that. Maybe that was his idea of leadership. That maybe in his vernacular, leadership and selfishness were the same thing. I don't know.
The Cavs had a lot of coaches when you were the voice of the Cavs. Whom were your favorites? Who were your favorites?
Yes. Obviously Bill Fitch.
Mm-hmm.
Because Fitch, he was instrumental in bringing me here. And we, of course, had gone back prior to that time, and I maintain a friendship with him to this day.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond Fitch, Lenny Wilkins, mm-hmm. whom I considered a great coach and an outstanding gentleman,
mm-hmm.
would certainly be probably number two on the hit parade. Now, one of the guys that I throw in that a lot of people raise their eyebrows and say, you're nuts, but Mike Fratello. Mm-hmm. I always put on my list of favorite coaches because that guy could get more out of less than anybody I ever saw. I mean, there were times when he was coaching teams that even that should not have even been in the CBA, really? Let alone the NBA, and somehow, some way, Fratello would get them to the playoffs. Now, as you well know, in the playoffs, they say you're supposed to take another step or two up the ladder. His teams had no more steps to take. They had exhausted every step getting to the playoffs, so they were quickly eliminated. But he did. He got more out of less. And then the other fellow that I really only had five games to get to know, but certainly first impressions were extremely favorable, was Byron Scott.
Okay. What about baseball? You once said that baseball was your favorite sport when you were a kid growing up.
Yep.
And then you became the Indians announcer for how many years?
17.
17 years you did the Indians?
Yes.
Wow, time flies.
And nobody remembers many of them.
How many years did you do television and then radio?
I did three games on radio in 72 when Bob Neal's wife passed away.
Oh.
Then came back and did the Indians on television in 72 shortly thereafter, because that's how Bill Flynn got a chance to hear me do baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Then in 73, Mulledy made me the play-by-play guy with Herb.
Oh, yes.
And I did that through 79. Then in 80, I flipped over to television and did TV with Bruce Drennan,
oh, yes.
Reggie Rucker,
oh, yeah.
and Jack Corrigan.
Uh-huh.
And then one final stint, it was when Sports Channel or Sports Vision or whatever they were calling it when it first reared its ugly head, they needed somebody to fill in for some games with Rick Manning.
Uh-huh.
And I went out to, I remember I went out with Rick on the road and we finished a very forgettable season with the Indians. But and that concluded my, until the Indians asked me to come back 20 years after the fact and do a game with Bruce on television.
Oh, yes.
A couple of years ago.
A nostalgia game.
Well, I told them that I'll be back to do it again in another 20 years.
Oh, that's good. What are your happier memories from doing the Indians?
Well, I had the great good fortune of three no-hitters. Dick Bosman in 74 against the Oakland A's. And a sidebar to that was the after the game, the writers all went into the Oakland clubhouse because they were world champs. And somebody asked Bill North, what's it like to be no-hit by Dick Bosman and the Indians? And he says, same thing as getting beat 10-9. The very next day on a Saturday afternoon, in the ninth inning, John Ellis delivers a bases-loaded single. The Indians win it 10-9. And sure enough, the stampede right back to Bill North saying, well, do you suppose that getting beat 10-9 just like getting no-hit?
I love it.
Oh, gee. And then, of course, Lenny Barker's perfect game,
yeah.
which was seen by 6,345,000
yeah.
fans.
Uh-huh.
And
6,000 of them actually had tickets.
Yes, that's right. And then the other one was Dennis Eckersley, no-hitting the Los Angeles Angels or California Angels,
yes.
whatever they're calling themselves.
Yes. He beat Frank Tanana.
That's right.
Memorial Day weekend. I'll never forget that.
Struck out Gil Flores to end the game. You can throw that one in here.
Whoa. A guy that, of course, I was traveling the baseball beat for a couple of your years back then in the late 70s. I was very fond of Jeff Torborg, the Indians manager.
Oh, yeah, great
you
guy.
You know, of all the – I also liked Doc Ellis.
Yes.
Now, we went through so many managers in that era with the Indians. Did any of those become friends of yours?
Well, Torborg did. Yeah. In fact, Torborg was the real estate agent on negotiating my winter in New Jersey when I spent it at Goose Gossage home.
Really?
In Wyckoff. And Torborg was the go-between who had to tell Goose that I would go to his house and take care of it for him and not, no wild parties or whatever else. And so Torborg's stamp of approval got me into Gossage House for the winter. And but Torborg was a great guy.
Some of my happy memories from traveling with the Indians was that after games, on more than one occasion, four of us would sit in the – they would close the bar by then, and maybe the coffee shop might still be open after a game. And I can remember nights where four of us would sit around. There would be you, me, Jeff Torborg, and Dwayne Kuiper.
Right.
And each of us eating or drinking something different. I would have my Miller Lite or something. You would have like a chocolate sundae or something. Kuiper was always drinking black coffee. And Torborg would have a milkshake or something.
Yep.
And we would sit around and talk about the game or just talk about things in general. Funny things that you remember from baseball because it is night after night. It is 50,000 miles a year.
Right.
And some of those moments of solitude or off the beaten path, out of the ballpark, stand out in my mind. And you probably have many of those memories yourself.
Well, that's true. And basketball was an entirely different situation, especially when we flew commercially before teams started getting their own planes or chartering planes.
Oh, yes.
And, I can vividly remember Dirk Minifield and Mel Turpin out at the airport at 1 o'clock in the morning eating hot dogs that were still revolving on the on the spit, somebody had gone home and left them there, maybe for the cleanup crew, and those two guys had found them first.
Before now, of course, in recent years, pro basketball teams have customized jetliners all fitted for 7-foot guys. Back in the days of buying 20 seats on a regularly scheduled airline and squeezing some of those 7-footers into those seats, that was not easy for those guys.
No. I flew from Seattle to Baltimore once between Luther Rackley and Walt Westley, 2 7-footers.
No.
Yes. And it gave me a whole different perspective.
Gee, that was tough on those guys.
Oh, yeah. Tougher on them than it was on me, actually.
Let me throw a name. Gary Suter, some of the great characters that... Did you know him very well? He wasn't with the team, with the Cavs first year.
Cavs first year, one of my most memorable ball players. He rarely played, and... the night that we were so beaten up physically that this Fitch decided to start him. When it came time for tip-off, Suter was nowhere to be found, in spite of the fact that he was elated previously that he was going to start. And so they sent Ron Culp, the trainer, back to see if for some reason Suter was still in the locker room. And Culp found Suter at a concession stand behind the bleachers with a hot dog in one hand and a beer in the other. And Suter's career with the Cavaliers ended right on that spot.
Really?
Just as soon as Culp came back and told Fitch. And so Suter unfortunately met a very untimely end. He took three bullets in the back in the swamp down near Memphis, reportedly due to a gambling problem.
No, really?
So.
I'm not going to ask you, I will. How many other people did you cover that wound up getting murdered? There was probably one or two others over the years.
I had a cousin that took two in the back going out of a bedroom window in Ely, Nevada. Does that count?
No. Okay, I'll give you another gold star for that one. Yeah. Okay. when you gave up baseball announcing, did you miss it? Back then you were also doing the Cavs and baseball. Joe, you never had a day off.
No, in fact, in 1974, when I was doing hockey, basketball, and baseball, I had 9 days in that year that I was not either traveling to, traveling from, or doing in that particular year.
And now you do one game a week. At the end of it, now you're retired from the Cavs.
Yep.
And you're doing Mount Union football.
That's right. And I love it.
And all those years you covered losing teams.
That's right.
Now you're ending in a blaze of glory with Mount Union.
I'm making up for it thanks to...
Perennial Division III national champion.
Tremendous program down at Mount Union.
What you once said to me that actually your best sport was football.
That, I think so.
Yeah, that's going back to your co-college or your Monmouth College days.
Yes. Yeah. And I think football, college football, Mount Union Monmouth type football, not Texas Tech versus SMU, but I'm talking good old down to the earth, play it on Saturday, forget about it Sunday, get in class on Monday, that kind of sports where it's not the be-all and the end-all. It's just part of the overall program or scene at a campus.
Okay. What's the state of the NBA? They're packing them in. Their television ratings are great. Riding high. Is that a correct assessment?
It would appear to be so. I don't know for sure. I mean, when I walked away from it, I walked away and closed the door and did not look back. It is just now that occasionally I'll take a peek and to see, you know, how they look. And I had not seen Kyrie Irving play until this year. When I came out of the ether or whatever it was out at the clinic on my open heart surgery, the nurse had put a Cavs game up on the television. And as I was coming out of the fog, I looked up and I could tell Cavaliers playing somebody, and the score was there at the bottom. It was somebody 82, Cavs 50, and I thought, oh my God, I have gone back to the beginning.
No, geez.
I'm having a flashback to that first year.
And that was, when did you have your open heart surgery?
2010.
And was it an emergency thing, or was it well planned that that's what you needed, and they set a date to do it?
That was a question of get it done or die.
Right.
I'd had two pulmonary embolisms for openers, and then that's when they went on and realized that I was going to have to get a cow in there to repair the damaged aortic valve.
Oh, so you got a bovine replacement valve?
Yes, so that's why now I tell you eat more chicken.
Who did your heart surgery? Do you remember his name?
Russian fellow.
I had a Dr. Gill do mine from
the clinic. That's how mine started, but it was, that's terrible.
That's all right.
I apologize to him. I can't.
That's all right. Did you give him a plug in the credits in your book? Your acknowledgments?
Yes, he's in there.
Me too. I gave my guy, even though they got about $70,000 for doing those, I think they were rewarded enough.
I'm going to walk away and suddenly his name will pop back in.
Uh-huh.
But it started the same way, Gil.
Yeah,
it was a Russian name.
Okay. How did you come out of that? A long recovery?
Yes, it was. It was a long recovery, and I still have to check in every 6 months to make sure that pieces, parts are still functioning properly. And
well, that's wonderful. So you see him, and then at the end, he says he gives you another 6 months.
That's
see
right.
you in 6 months. I can't beat that deal.
I don't see the surgeon. That's why I probably would remember his name. I see Dr. Griffin, and he is the guy that...
Right, you never see your surgeon after that.
No.
You know, they go in, they do their work, get out, and they don't even send a postcard. They don't call. They don't write.
Yeah. Although he did stop to say hi at one of those final five games I did for the Cavaliers.
Really?
Yeah, he stopped by and said hi. I said I didn't recognize him without the mask over his nose.
Oh. You've had a wonderful life. You've seen a lot of things. Will you object to that? Will you argue that point?
Well, I've had a great existence. Good Lord, you know, my wife was in horse racing for over 20 years,
yes.
and I assisted her, and that's a whole different world, horse racing and the people who populate it and all that goes on with it, especially when you're at the bottom of the food chain, as we were at Thistledown and Finger Lakes yeah. and places like that. I spent an afternoon at Hollywood Park with Pete Newell, Wayne Embry, and Dr. Jerry Buss, the owner
really?
Of the Lakers, who is big into horse racing. And Wayne Embry told him, he said, listen to the stories that Joe's got about horse racing. And I started to regale him with stories about what my wife had encountered and all. He just sat there for about 40 minutes. He said, you know, I'd heard that it was like that out there, but he says, I didn't realize no. it was really like
oh,
that.
Oh, no.
And then he called his son over, who was a trainer, and yeah. had me regale him with more stories. Yeah. So,
you got bit by a spider real bad at in a barn.
Yes.
One time.
Yep.
Was this in your own barn in Medina?
No, this was at the racetrack at Thistledown.
Really?
Yeah, we were unloading hay, and evidently a spider came in on a bale of hay that
really?
Nailed me. I remember feeling the bite, and I think I stomped on whatever it was. But then, ironically, that day, Jeannie and I were going to Reno and for a little vacation.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I got to the hotel in Reno, I was not feeling well. And the next day, the next morning, I got up and I was really not feeling well. And so we hopped in a car, and I remember stopping at the desk and say, where's the closest hospital? And the guy had no clue. I says, he could tell you every hotel, every casino, every brothel, every pawn shop in Reno, but he can't tell you where the hospital is. But we found one, and it was actually Jeannie who spotted the black vein going up my leg. And when they saw that, they says, oops. Because out there, they're used to spiders, tarantulas, and other things biting people. So they knew what to do. And I was in a case of semi-consciousness for about 3 days.
Really? Okay. What was the happiest sports day of your life?
The happiest?
Yeah, could it have been the final game of that Baltimore series or the Washington series basketball in 1976? Or could it have been one of those no-hit games that you broadcast? Or
you know what? I'm going to tell you
what?
An honest answer to that. I've only cried once in my life for happiness. And it was the day that my wife, Jean, won her first race as a trainer, Indiana Panorama, and they gave us a little trophy. And I remember about everybody in the office down at the Coliseum had put $2 on Indiana Panorama. And so, you know, I had a nice payoff for these people because the horse went off at about 12-1. So, and just with that little trophy sitting there and knowing how much she had put in to getting to that point in her career, I really did. I cried. It was that much of a moment for me. And I can't ever remember crying at any other time in my life, in terms of sports anyway.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. What a wonderful way to wrap this up. But I know that you've seen so much. Is there any remembrance or story that you think we would be remiss in not including in our conversation today?
Well, I got so many that, you know, one would lead to another, and then we would be here asking for more tape or whatever is in that machine. So I will say this. There have been some good times. There have been some bad times. But as my dad told me many years ago, if you add up the pluses and the minuses and it comes out plus, then you're all right and you should be happy with what's gone on. So I would say my life has more pluses than minuses. So I may not have done things that will shape the face of the planet, but at least I had a good time doing what I did.
Well, I think the people who've listened to you here in Cleveland for over 40 years are inclined to agree. You've given people in this town so many thrills. Yes. Okay, Joe Tate, thanks for sharing this hour with us.
Thank you.